Welcome to Business Game Changers, where you'll hear expert tips on the big issues and the hottest trends to level up your business game. If you're building a career or building a business, this is Must Hear Radio. Here's your host, Sarah Westall.
Welcome to Business Game Changers. I'm Sarah Westall. Corey Kogan joins us today, who is the author of The Five Choices. The Five Choices is a program that is new from Franklin Covey. She is the top leader in the productivity practice, and she's also the author of this new book. And it has the incredible distinction of being on the top-selling list of the Wall Street Journal. And Franklin Covey has formed a whole practice around this concept, the five choices. And she's going to come today and explain what that's about and how that differs from the past. With our new knowledge-based workforce, the old methods for improving efficiency just doesn't work very well. And this is a new framework for becoming more productive. And she explains it and helps us understand what the benefits of this is. But before we get into that, we have the privilege of having Joe Miller back, who is an expert leadership coach. And she gives us some more useful tips in leadership. Today, we'll discuss the transition from doing to leading from both a worker and management perspective. And her insights are always useful for all levels in your business. So first, let's welcome Joe to the program. Hi, Joe. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Sarah. It's great to speak with you again.
Okay, so what is a leader? I mean, you hear leadership all the time being thrown around everywhere, but really, what is leadership?
Great question. Yes, what is a leader? And by the way, I want to acknowledge that the world is full of great leadership books and leadership gurus and definitions of leadership, and probably the last thing the world needs right now is one more, but I'm going to share mine with you anyway.
Okay, go for it.
And to do that, I want to tell a quick story. So many years ago, I was traveling to Canada to deliver a leadership training to a group of technical women in a big telecommunications firm there. And as part of the prerequisites of the program, they'd each filled in a pre-workshop questionnaire. And one of the questions on the questionnaire was, what does being a leader mean to you? And as I was sitting on that plane at 30,000 feet reading their answers, I started to feel myself get maybe just a little frustrated with this group of women, even though we hadn't met yet, because one after another, what they were saying is, oh, I don't know if being a leader is really important to me. I just want to come to work every day and make the greatest difference that I can. And then, of course, it hit me that maybe that's part of what it means to be a leader. And so from there, I started to really think on that and came up with my own definition, which is that being a leader means, certainly being someone who's coming to work every day looking to make the biggest impact that you can. And that if you do that consistently, there's going to come a point in time when you're given a goal or a project or a mandate that's bigger than you can accomplish alone. And in that moment, you need to lead and engage and motivate and inspire others to pitch in and collaborate with you. And in that moment, you become a leader because you're out to make something great happen that's bigger than you can make happen on your own. So my definition of leader is being someone who's out to make a greater positive impact that is bigger than you could accomplish through your own effort. And hopefully what you'll see through that definition is you can really be a leader at any point in your life and in your career. It's really about more about what you're out to make happen rather than a job title or a role.
Yeah, because you can be a manager and not be a leader. We've all seen that. Or you can be a person who doesn't manage anyone but really be a leader just by how you behave and how you inspire others through your actions.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's we all can think of that manager that we had that was truly not a leader. It's much harder to think of that example of that up-and-comer or the person who's in an individual contributor role who is taking the lead and making a great impact. They're often the great unsung heroes in every organization, but they exist. And I really encourage people to look out for who are the people in their organization that perhaps don't have a big fancy title or a position that you think would hold a lot of influence, but are there making great things happen. You know, those are your leaders, and it's really important to know who those individuals are.
Well, what do you do when you have a really good person who is maybe worth 100 people? You know, I mean, they're the best doer in your organization,
And, you know, you see it a lot in technology firms where somebody really could be worth about 100 people and what they're doing. And is it, you know, a lot of management have a problem with promoting those people to a leadership position because they're afraid of moving them out of their role? What? What's your take on that?
Yeah, and also what you do when you are that person yourself, when you suspect
exactly.
that you're too valuable to be promoted and your management might be holding you in place. And I think the thing to really start with is, what does this individual want? You know, do they aspire to stay in the role that they're in and just make the greatest positive impact they can every day for the rest of their career? And if so, being a real high-performing individual contributor, you know, an expert, a thought leader at what they do might be the pinnacle role for them in their career, and moving them into a management position might be, you know, just the worst calamity for them and for the organization, not to mention the people that they're tasked with managing. So I think it really all starts with that individual and, you know, what are their aspirations and where do they see.
And you have to be careful, right? Because if they really want to, that's where their passion lies, then you don't want to move them out. But if they want to aspire to more and you don't move them out, then they might leave.
Yeah, exactly. And then, you know, then you start to look at taking that really, that most challenging leap that people take in their career, which is making the leap from doing to leading. And I think one of the hardest things about it is you probably won't get promoted into that management or leadership role unless you already start to demonstrate that you're capable of doing both. So before you get to be in a pure leadership role, you have to show that you can do and lead at the same time, which is really challenging. But for anyone, I think, that's listening in, that's currently in a pre-leadership role but really aspires to be, you know, you're coming up against that great challenge that you face in your career, which is you can't get that next level job without leadership experience, but you can't also get the experience without the job. And so you really need to sort of take your career in your own hands and find ways to develop yourself as a leader and show that you can go beyond the role that you're in and start to lead as well as doing before you're likely to be handed that next level leadership position.
Because they need to see you as someone who can do that before they'll give you the chance to do it, right?
Yeah, exactly.
It's kind of the catch-22, so you have to show that you have that ability. But do leaders often struggle in different areas?
Oh, definitely. I, you know, and I can think of so few people that I would consider to be the born leader. You know, occasionally we'll hear about them. They kind of, you know, sprang from the womb and started their career and they have like this incredible package of leadership skills. But most people honestly aren't like that. For most of us, we need to work on and develop. And I think that's where it's really great to have a great mentor or a manager who really gets you and is a great coach to you and help you see, you know, what you're capable of, but also help you address some of the weaknesses that might be a fatal flaw. I think we all know it's important to focus on our strengths, but if you really aspire to climb in your career, you need to understand what might be your critical derailers and work on those and overcome those.
And make sure they don't derail you. You might not ever be really, really good at it, but they shouldn't mess you up. You got to get to the point where they don't mess you up and derail you, like you're saying.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, you know, most of the leadership characteristics that, you know, we know really go into the bundle of skills that make an effective leader, most of them, when you pull them apart one by one, aren't that difficult. It's just when we sort of think of them all as this bundled together package that seems so difficult to attain that I think people get a bit intimidated. But if you break it down one by one, you know, strategy, what is strategy? Well, Ellie Pideaux, who is a VP of strategy at Medtronic, said, this is my favorite quote about strategy. She said, strategy is a fancy way of coming up with a long-term plan and putting it into action. And when you break it down like that, it's like, oh yeah, that's doable.
Yeah, all these words, these fancy words, when you break it down, it's really not that big of a deal. You just have to, yeah. And sometimes people who talk very simply actually get the most done. And unfortunately, they're not viewed as leaders, but they truly are kind of the best leaders because they're just making it simple for everybody around them. That's what I've experienced anyways. But so are leaders treated differently than other workers?
Of all the questions that you prepped me in advance to really think about for this conversation, that's the one I'm struggling with. I'm still thinking through. But I think, you know, we all know when someone has that almost indefinable it factor, that leadership presence, that quality, and they walk in a room, we just kind of know, don't we? People just kind of sense, oh, that's a true leader. And I think if someone has that ability to walk in a room and maybe not even speak much or say much and yet have people look to them and recognize leadership, I mean, that's an incredible quality, and I don't think many leaders have it. But we certainly all know it when we see it. The rest of us, I think, are kind of working on that and aspiring to build that incredible presence.
Well, and there's that charisma and the kind of that glow that some people have. But would you say that also people in leadership positions are held to higher standards than others?
You would hope so. And if they're not, then I think there's a problem in your organization. So, yes.
Well, sure. Yeah. And if you get promoted or put into a different position, you can do things in your individual contributor role that you now are being scrutinized over. And, you know, I've seen a lot of things where people have been promoted and they do the same behaviors they did before, but now suddenly they're not accepted for that. And so they have to be very careful.
Yes. Yeah. I think this is one of the reasons why having a great mentor or a great coach to help you make the transition is really a valuable thing. I think the best leaders know how important it is to lead by example. And really think very consciously every day, am I doing that? Am I leading by example? And am I being the type of leader that I would look to and want to be led by as well?
Well, this was excellent, Joe. And I know we're going to have you back again just to give us these periodic leadership talks. But that's why you're one of the top leaders in the country on teaching executives and stuff on these things. So once again, where can they get your information?
You know what? Visit my blog, beleaderly.com, which is a place we really created for women who want to lead, climb, and thrive as rising women of influence. So there's a lot of articles, and we'll post this podcast there as well, but little videos and stuff like that to help people on their leadership journey.
Okay, that sounds great. Thank you so much, Joe, for joining us today.
Thanks, Sarah. It's a good conversation, as always.
Yes.
As always, if you want contact information for any of our guests or today for Joe Miller, please go to my website at sarahwestall.com. You can also find it on my radio page at webtalkradio.net. Now, let's welcome Corey Kogan to the program.
Hi, Corey. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Franklin Covey has a program for improving productivity that you've pretty much spearheaded with your book, which focuses around five choices. What does that mean?
Well, you know, the productivity in the 21st century is really about our ability to think. And so it is about how am I intentionally making the choices to make sure I feel accomplished at the end of the day. And we say in working with our neuroscientists that there are five of those out of the many choices you can make out there that'll really help you do that.
So you had a 6-year study, Franklin Covey did, of over 350,000 respondents indicating that more than 40% of their time was being spent on activities that were not important to them or to their organization and so forth. Why do people do that? What is going on there?
Well, it's very interesting because, you know, that's a norm around the world. So if you imagine that, organizations where essentially they're telling us they feel like, or the workers are telling us from the top of the bottom of the organization that they feel like they're wasting half their time. Some of it is reality and some of it is perceived. And it's just, you know, they feel like they're working on other people's priorities. They're doing things they don't understand why it's important. So it just has become a norm. And with no energy, you know, entropy says it'll continue to degrade. So when people put a little energy to that, they can change those numbers pretty quickly.
And that's what the focuses of five choices really are, is trying to figure out how to get that 40% down to a more reasonable number.
Down to a what?
A more reasonable, I suppose 40% could be reasonable depending how you look at it, but a lower number.
Well, that 40%, you know, people don't have time to stop and think about it, but is a huge cost to an organization. And it's become standard operating procedure. It's sort of the cost of doing business. So when you think about it, if you had systems in place, both on the individual and organizational level, where people were able to reduce that by 10 or 20%, the return to the person by their own feeling of accomplishment and the organization, an engaged workforce that is focused on the right things, imagine how it affects the outcomes of the organization. So it's a pretty big deal.
And for themselves. I mean, they'll just be so much more productive if they can reduce that to a smaller percent. So, well, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to say, when you imagine when somebody is able to think about, boy, today I was really busy, but I got some really key things done. I got important things done. And it just, they go to sleep at night feeling like they made a contribution, which, to be honest, is a basic human need.
Well, and sometimes you do something. I know some days I just don't feel like I got a lot done, but then I think about it and I think, well, geez, I got some big things accomplished. And even though I didn't get a lot of little things accomplished, I got some of the big things that probably will mean more in the long run.
Right.
So what are activities are considered wasteful versus productive?
You know, it's a great question you're asking, because what I always, you know, say to people that I'm working with or when I'm speaking is you can't leave this conversation or a keynote or whatever I'm doing and go, well, Corey said that's a wasteful activity. It is all situational, and it's based on what is important to you. What is what we call our quadrant twos at a choice one. And then you have to decide what's waste. So, you know, reading a People magazine, which is one of my favorite things to do, happens to be very relaxing for me. It's not wasteful when I'm on an airplane after, you know, a big day with a client and I recharge by taking a little downtime with People magazine. If all I did was read People magazines and it was taking away from work that I should be doing or the family that I need to be engaged with, then we say now that's wasteful. So it's a very big conversation and really important to understand that every individual needs to understand what's important to them and then decide what's wasteful or what's not.
So playing Candy Crush can be okay.
to be honest, and this is my take on it, because you can't be perfect. You know, it's, well, you have to do important things. You can't do anything else. I'm not a believer in that. I believe in recharging. And if somebody is taking 10, 15, even 30 minutes because Candy Crush relaxes them and it's not taking away from something else that's more important, then in fact, it's like, okay, great. I did my 30 minutes. Now I'm going to put all my energy into this project and the project's going to come out even better.
So your company has done extensive research on how the brain, you know, brain activity works to understand behavior. What are some of the most important findings in your research around that area?
I love this subject because really, time management productivity is the optimization of mental labor in the 21st century versus industrialization of the last century. So spend a lot of time here. A couple of things. Number one, that we have to live in our thinking brain, not be guided by our reactive brain. That's where mindless answering of email, et cetera, comes from. So being really intentional and really mindful. And that when we do that, we can rewire our brain cells in order to create new good habits of productivity. That's one. Second one that's really important, all kinds of research. You can't do more than one thing really well at a time. I know lots of people are able to multitask. It's a big conversation. That's a skill in its own right. So we can switch between things very well. But all the research shows you can only do one thing well at a time. That, to me, is one of the key principles of the brain science.
So basically, you're thinking about one thing. And then when you're multitasking, you're thinking about one thing. And then you're switching and then thinking about another one and then going back to the other one. So you just keep switching back and forth to the focus of what you're doing. Is that
correct?
Well,
right. Yeah, with multitasking, I mean, you think about the classic example of a mother who is taking care of the kids, cooking dinner, you know, has all the balls up in the air and is doing a good job. And when you think about it, I'm sitting at my desk, I'm answering email, I'm working on a project. You could have all those balls up in the air, but are you really doing good work on the project while you're answering people's questions, you're answering your email, et cetera? And the research shows if you really want to do good work, focus on the person who's trying to talk to you or focus on the project, but don't try to do all of them at the same time.
And that's because you're the deep thinking occurs when you're more singularly focused.
Yeah, and that's what I'm saying. The research shows, even in the brain structures, that you are doing, you really, your best work is done when you are singularly focused on one thing, you know, to get it done.
Well, going back a little bit to the mindless part of your brain, could working on mindless things just be kind of relaxing too?
Well, that goes back to the People magazine, right? So yes, but again, the point is you have to hold yourself accountable. We do. So if I'm mindlessly doing something, is it relaxing? And then am I mindlessly wasting time? So for instance, somebody might be Googling, right? Oh, let me look up something. And then you mindlessly end up going, you know, just to these other links and 2 hours have gone by. Well, the first link or second link was, you know, fine. But after that, I just kept going mindlessly. And I like, oh my goodness, look at all the time that's gone by, 20 links down the road. So mindless behavior could be relaxing for a few minutes. You need to discern when it is now encroaching on other more important things to do.
And is, you know, the stuff that's not mindless, things that are deep thought, those take a lot more work, right? It's a lot more exercise for your brain. Can you train your brain to be able to handle it longer? Because I know that when I spend more time on things that are deep thinking, I get tired.
Well, you know, your brain overall takes about 20% of your energy load at any given moment in time. So you're right. You know, when you've really been thinking, you are expending an enormous amount of energy. So like you said, when you're done, it's like, wow, I'm really tired. Or for some people, if they've had a, you know, an argument or a tense moment with their spouse or partner, it's like afterwards, you're exhausted. And it does. It takes an enormous amount of energy. And we say around the five choices that the core skills we're mastering is around decision management and attention management. Those two suck the life out of you, which is why the third skill is energy management. So you have to keep your brain pretty darn healthy, which goes to choice five, in order to fuel it to be able to do this kind of productivity work.
Okay, this is off the subject, but if it uses so much energy, can you lose weight by just thinking on it?
You know, I'm not a doctor, so I'm not going to go there, but I think there's got to be some, I don't know if you're going to lose weight, but I do think you're burning calories.
Oh, that's funny. Okay. Well, I want to go through these different choices. You have five choices, and I'd like you to talk about each one of them and describe what it means and how this all fits together. Your choice one is act on the important, don't react to the urgent. So what does that mean?
So that's the first half of decision management skills. Act on the important, don't react to the urgent. So we've already talked about mindfulness, being intentional, right? Working in your thinking brain. You need a process. So act on the important, don't react to the urgent is about utilizing the time matrix, a course, you know, Covey principle and application-based process. And it's the confluence of the word urgent and important that makes up four quadrants. Is something necessary? It's a quadrant to do right now. It's a quadrant one. Is it a distraction? It's urgent, not important. It's a quadrant three. Is it not urgent, not important? Quadrant four, it's a waste. Or is it quadrant two, important, not urgent? So everything you do needs to be discerned through that time matrix. And what we say is you need to pause, clarify, and decide to get the greatest return on the moment utilizing the time matrix.
Okay, so you're referring to a chart that or a time matrix chart, right?
Yes.
And it has four quadrants in it. And what is choice one? What quadrant are you talking about again?
Well, quadrant one is things that are urgent and important. They're necessary to do right now.
Okay. And there's four quadrants. And what's the worst quadrant to be in?
Three and four, you know, below the line, we say those two have the greatest opportunity to reclaim time, attention, and energy, because both of those represent unimportant things. So when you think about the 60-40 survey, that 40% is representative of quadrants 3 and 4.
Okay, so 3 and 4 is non-productive time, and 1 and 2 is productive time.
Correct.
Okay, and so the goal is to stay in the 1 and 2 quadrants and out of 3 and 4.
Well, the goal is really to get as much time, attention, and energy into quadrant 2, which is important and not urgent.
Oh, okay, yes. Okay.
Knowing that we're going to have the crises of quadrant 1 that are necessary to do right now, but a real opportunity is to mitigate the time spent there, because so many of us are crisis driven. We tend to gravitate there, and that's really a stress, you know, it's really a stressful place to be.
Well, and do you think that people who are managing crises all the time actually look more like heroes, and people who are proactive and just don't seem to have problems aren't noticed?
Yeah, that's also a very, very big conversation. And I will challenge people, and this is on Twitter as well. This was resonated heavily, where I'm challenging people around, are you busy or are you productive? Because busy has become the badge of honor. And really, it's like, oh, I'm so busy. Yeah, me too. I'm busier than you. And it's false accomplishment. And so really, people need to change their mindset around that to go, you know what? Today was a crazy day, but I got those 3 or 4 things done personally, professionally, you know, that really mattered. And the other stuff fell in around it. That's the conversation that should highlight productivity. But we've just all socialized to this crisis-driven, busy is the badge of honor. And it's interesting, Sarah, because when I bring that to people's attention, I've had them, and like I said, I've seen it in the media and social media, where they go, ugh, I'm taking that badge off. You're right. I have to think about being productive. So that's a great thing.
Well, I think it's important for managers, too, to look and see what employees are actually getting the most accomplished and not necessarily look at the person who's running around the most. They might be trying harder, sort of, but the person who gets the most done is really your most valuable employee.
This is the game changer right here. If everybody just became mindful of that, because even those managers are really at risk, because they are the ones that feel like they need to do everything for everybody. So if they would just, and that drives their employees crazy, because then they feel like they need to model the manager. So if everybody just got mindful and said, how could we, and that's why this time matrix is a language and methodology that should flow from the top of the organization to the bottom. Because if everybody's speaking the same language and they create a safe environment where people can get clear on quadrant 2, they can check it and say, you know, this feels a little quadrant 3-ish. Can you tell me why it is a 2 or a 1? And people stopped feeling like busy was what needed to be rewarded. It's amazing how much more, even in good organizations, how much more greatness would show up.
And how much more peacefulness you would have. I mean, it's more peaceful and less stressful and more enjoying.
Which makes people want to come back again tomorrow and do it again.
Okay, let's move on to choice 2, which is go for the extraordinary, don't settle for ordinary. What does that mean?
So that's the second half of decision management skills, because if we have a system of discernment, the time matrix, so we know how to handle all of the incoming, then now it's time to get really clear on, so what is my potential? We have the research that shows that particularly the knowledge workers of the 21st century have like unlimited capacity to do even better work, be more accomplished than they are today. And so you got to get at that. And the way we get at that is going for extraordinary is for people to identify the few most important roles in their life right now. Not 10 years from now, not in the past, but just today, out of all the roles you have, get really mindful. What are the few, no more than 6-ish, that I have to be really pretty good at, you know, today, meaning extraordinary, meaning at the end of the day, I want to feel like I've made the right contribution as a mother, as a spouse or partner, as a practice leader, as a dog mother, and evaluate how you're currently doing. This is called labeling and reappraising in the neuroscience world. You make it very real for you by getting this down on paper and a visual. And you just evaluate, how am I doing? Seeing where the opportunities are, applauding and, you know, feeling good about what you're doing well at. What you'll see here is work-life balance, you know, good or bad or somewhere in between. And then creating what we call quadrant two role statements, targets of potential. As a practice leader, I will, you know, enable the capacity of people around the world to feel more accomplished at the end of the day. As a daughter, I will, you know, connect with my dad on a regular basis in the last few years of his life. And these are broad, purpose-driven statements that as the day is going by, all of my decisions are based on, am I contributing to these few most important roles in my life right now? And it keeps out some of the, you know, things that I might consider waste. I'm not letting myself mindlessly go there. That's quadrant two. So, I mean, that's choice two.
What about extraordinary? Some people are, it's almost stressful in and of itself to think that I have to be extraordinary at everything. You know, you get to a point where I just can't be good at everything. So what does that really mean? What does the word extraordinary really mean?
It's a great conversation to have, and we've had around the world, because even culturally, that word, you know, is defined differently. We don't mean you have to, you know, solve world peace, you know, if you don't want to. Extraordinary to us is that I go to sleep at night feeling like I made the right contribution in that role. That's what it means. So, and even in these few roles that we've defined, you can't be constantly at the, you know, every day I've made a huge contribution or, you know, in that role. It's dynamic. It depends on the incoming and what's going on. So, you know, for me right now, I'm putting a lot more energy. Yeah, as a daughter, I'm pulling from some other roles, you know, as my father's going through some things, and he's doing great, actually. So, you know, this becomes a little bit of a negotiation, both with yourself and with others. But the fact that you have this framework of what does high contribution mean in each of these roles, and then each day you manage the incoming and circumstances to get as close as you can, knowing you can't be perfect, nor should you want to be every day.
Well, because there's an illness just around that perfectionist,
right?
You know, thing. And there's you. If you're trying to be amazing at everything, then you start to move into quadrant three and four, right?
That is exactly right. It's holistic, you know. So even as a practice leader, I put a lot of energy. I'm in, you know, New York with my dad, blah blah blah. It's not day to day necessarily. I don't have to do something wonderful every single day. My day might go by and I'm thinking there's no big thing I need to do in my role as a mentor or, you know, a practice leader. But in the bigger picture of the weeks and the months, you know, the every day's activities add up together to help me achieve the potential that I have in each role.
Because if you try too hard in one role, then another one's going to slip. And it just doesn't work, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it just, okay, so let's move on to choice three, which is schedule the big rocks, don't sort the gravel.
Yeah, so this actually really answers what we were just talking about. So it's the first half of attention management skills. You have to have the systems in place to execute on everything we just did. And so scheduling the big rocks, don't sort gravel is about what we call the 30-10 promise. 30 minutes before the week starts to do weekly planning. And that, all that, what that means, and we say 30 minutes so that you get into your thinking brain. You don't try to do this on the run. You really need to think about it. Pull out your role statements, just glance at them and remind yourself, that's right, that's even under the pressure of, you know, the day-to-day, you know, you get buried under that. That's who I am. Your master tasks, take a look at that. And schedule in for the next week, the few most important things that need to be done. That's why I'm saying it's not necessarily about every single day, but next week, you know, I've got an interview with Sarah, a meeting with the Minnesota, you know, business service organization. I need to get ready for that. I have a call with another client I need to prepare for. Those are my three big rocks in my role as a practice leader. Calling my father a couple of times this week. So I'm getting all of that into my calendar before the week starts, before the gravel starts flowing. 10 minutes at the end of each day to reconcile my calendar and be vigilant about it. Some things will get accomplished. The gravel, other Q1s are going to, you know, knock me off my game. So I have to move things to another time slot. But I'm constantly managing the incoming and making sure I've got things planned out. I will tell you that planning really is the number one quadrant to activity. It is important. It is not urgent. And if you want to get the right things done, you must do this choice really well.
Well, what do you do when you have a bunch of urgents that are gravel, but some of that gravel can turn into a bigger deal over time? And you get to a point where you can't do something that's really important that you've wanted to do because it's really not urgent. And so, like, if you want to write a book or something, and that book just never gets done because you always have so much gravel or you have so much urgency, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And what happens, you know, and I'm a realist. This happens to me too. Things get pushed off, but here's what I know. You know, we've partnered with a number of the neuroscientists. Dr. Heidi Halverson, who wrote the book, Succeed, is quoted in our videos and in the book saying there are thousands of studies that show that the more specific you get, the higher the probabilities of accomplishment by 200 to 300%. You want to write a book? Then get it in your calendar that in 6 months, on the beginning of September, whatever 6 months is, it's in my calendar that first week, I'm going to start working on that book. You will find between that and the mental gymnastics of rewiring your brain to be more thoughtful and mindful, you will raise the probabilities of that happening. Gravel is like just, you know, you're bobbing along on the ocean. It's just going to carry you, you know, through the urgency unless you put a stake in the ground through planning.
And if you don't do it, then you're never really going to get anywhere, right? I mean, you're just going to be treading water.
Treading water is the great analogy. And when September 1st comes and you look at your calendar and you've got the time, but you go, not now, then you have to question yourself, do I really want to write a book?
Well, because, yeah, maybe you're not motivated.
Because it takes purpose and passion.
Exactly.
That's a driver. That's the, you know, Daniel Pink, Dr. Adam Grant research around purpose and passion, around productivity. If you don't have it, then just get it off your calendar and move on.
That's a good point. So, and that goes with anything that you... But there are certain things that I have absolutely zero motivation for, but really needs to get done, like exercising. How do you get past that?
Well, there's a bigger picture to that. So in your, you know, so you have to decide, you got to go higher than that. Why are you exercising? What role, you know, is that playing for you? You know, that if you can answer that for yourself, you want to be a role model for the kids. You want to look nicer for whoever. You want to feel better for your health. You have to understand what the motivation is that's driving you to exercise and focus on that, not the exercise itself.
Well, and I think this all ties into the energy as we get into the, I think that's choice five, as you say, you get so tired because you're spending so much time thinking and working hard that the energy level just isn't there to exercise. So maybe, what do we plan it so it's in the morning so that before we get wiped out?
Corey said I should exercise in the morning.
But you know my point.
I do. It has to be for you. And when we get to choice five, there's five energy drivers too. There's not just one and they're integrated. So maybe there's some improvement required in some of the others that will help you exercise. But I will go back to purpose and passion. Go higher. Why are you, why do you want to exercise? What's the outcome of that? And that should fill you with a little more. I've got my own stuff going on now. I'm actually excited because I'm doing a much better job of exercising. And some of it is, you know, this is what happens with bad news, right? So I've got some back issues and too many people have told me that I need to strengthen my core. And not to mention, and I'm a small person, but I was looking at myself in the mirror and I thought, that thing around my waist, I need to work on that. And a few months, and I've got some other personal things going on with my, like I said, my parents and stuff. And a few months ago, I just really, I said, you know what, in my self role to be healthy and my back and stuff like that, I need to strengthen my core, period. And I'm so amazed because morning and night, I'm up to like 70 sit-ups, you know, 3 or 4 planks at 30 seconds apiece. And I look forward to it. I couldn't be happier. And that it hasn't always been how I am. But I have a greater outcome to if I get my core strengthened, my back already feels better. I've lost that little roll around my stomach. I'm thrilled.
Well, and you can have so much more energy too, right? You can.
I do. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, this number 4, I like number 4 because I think we all can identify with this. Rule your technology, don't let it rule you. You know, with everybody being, you're just bombarded with stuff. So can you explain that?
Yeah, so again, second half of attention management. We've got our planning systems in place, and it would be a real shame if we just continue to let our behavior around our technology bombard, you know, take us off our game. And so we have to rule our technology. So the first thing you need to do is really get mindful about, again, using the quadrants. That is foundational. So you must get conscious of when you're picking up your smartphone and reacting to stuff. And ask yourself, am I using my technology in a quadrant 3, quadrant 4 kind of way? Whether it's at work or at home. And I hear so many amazing confessions from people as they get mindful and say, yeah, I pick up my smartphone like it's a pack of cigarettes, or I'm on CNN 100 times a day. I don't know why. Or at home, I realize I'm worried about work-life balance, but I get home, I go right on my iPad and I don't talk to my husband. So getting in touch with this and breaking those patterns is number one in ruling your technology. And then the second piece, now we can align with, I mean, it's amazing what you can do when you just think about all of your information, you know, like a pile on your desk or your email, and realizing that all that information can only be one of 4 things. It can only be a contact, an appointment, a task, or a note. You have 4 buckets. And so when you think about that, if you just cleaned up the pile or you thought about your email, putting them in those buckets, you will have an amazing information system. And what I mean about that is if you have a calendar, it should sync across all your devices. Your task list should sync across all your devices. So you have one of each of those, and suddenly you're not, you know, on your hands and knees under your desk looking for information on a post-it note. You can go right to where information is. And that's the first part of ruling your technology.
Well, and people, it's not uncommon in our family for me to look around. I have 2 teenagers to look around and everyone's on their smartphone. We're at a dinner table or we're out to eat and everyone's on their smartphone, including my parents, grandma and grandpa. So everybody's on the phones, and we're starting to have rules now that you have to turn your phone off when we're having dinner. But that's become such a habit, and you're always getting messages, and you're always getting, and you have to, didn't tell me if you agree with this. You almost have to have the confidence just to turn it off. Right?
Yes. So Dr. Ed Hallowell, who wrote the book, Driven to Distraction and Crazy Busy, also one of our partners in the 5 Choices, He clearly says that picking up your smartphone is like picking up a pack of cigarettes, and your brain loves novel things. So with the dings, the pings, who needs me now? The brain always wants to know what's going on out there. And so it's just this perfect storm, addiction kind of thing. And it's just, we've wired ourselves so hard to that we all just do it, and it's become the norm. I sort of like to call it the wild, wild west of technology. And, when you're talking about dinner, a funny story, I live in Tucson, Arizona, and so sometimes we'll go to the resorts for lunch. And in January, I always know when there's somebody from Minnesota, Wisconsin, or any of the other northern states on vacation in Tucson, because you all come down, because I'm in my winter coat and you all are in your shorts. So I'm
But we laugh at the winter coats too.
I know. Well, I know, but we're freezing. We have thin blood down here. So I'll see a family like yours sitting like right at this beautiful table by the pool. Everybody's on their devices. And I'm thinking, well, at least they're warm on their devices. But here's what I think. It's become the norm. And the more I look at this and think about it, and we say, all right, we're going to have dinner together. Everybody needs to put their smartphones away. Because I just went through this with my family last weekend. And what we did was we said, here's the topic we're going to talk about. Because what happens is it's like, okay, let's have dinner and let's just, be a family. Well, everybody needs an end in mind. Your brain needs a target. So I've now decided we need to substitute for the brain. So what are we going to talk about? We're going to talk about, everybody's going to talk about one thing that they did really well at school today, or we're going to talk about what happened at work so that people don't just sort of stare at each other.
And the teenagers, they're like, well, what are we?
Right.
What am I going to do?
Right. So, and then what happens is they start to itch, like you would pick up a pack of cigarettes because they've got nothing. They start to itch to, I need to pick up my smartphone. So that's my new recommendation. Pick a couple of topics at the dinner table that everybody participates in.
Well, and have you done any research on what the younger generation is how they're going to deal with technology? Because I got to tell you, the difference between the messages and things I get, it's nothing compared to the kids. They get hundreds and hundreds of messages every day, and they're just constant to the point where they can't keep up with it, obviously, but that rules their entire life. And they have we grew up and we didn't have that. There, and so now we're trying to adapt to it, and we don't want all that because we never really had that. Now that's what they grew up with, and that's all they know. So, what is, and millennials are a lot like that. So what's the difference?
Well, this is the whole, each one of you questions we could talk about all day, right?
I'm sure. Yes.
This is the digital natives versus the digital immigrants. And we have to be really careful because they are growing up with technology. So I see two-year-olds sitting, the airports a lot, sitting on chairs with their phones and playing games and, doing learning things as well. But we can't, just because it wasn't our world, we can't, as they're growing up with this in their mouths, it's become their arms and legs, and then say, okay, but now you need to put it down. So we have to be careful about what digital norms are. And everybody needs to adapt, to some degree. I will tell you that with millennials in the workforce, it's been interesting what I've seen with it. Number one, we have to go with the flow of their, use of technology as a norm. And again, even using the quadrants. So they feel the same way. But what's really important is that I've seen some millennials, once they're in the workplace, because think about the other side of millennials. They want to be the CEO right now. That's what we talk about all the time.
Yeah. They don't understand why not.
Why not? But they really do want to do good work.
Sure,
I mean, their work
yes.
ethic, I think, is coming out is pretty, pretty strong. And so what I have found from them is they've told me, I have had to go back and get a regular phone while I'm at work, a cell phone, because I can't have my friends. I can't be that distracted. It's distracting me all day long while I'm trying to do good work. So I think some of them are realizing their brains can only do so much. So there is some of that going on, a little bit of a renaissance as well. But we all have to figure out what digital norms are. And, it's this whole knowledge worker space with potential is really open for systems like the five choices as a process to get to extraordinary productivity, because it takes all of this into consideration.
Well, let's get on to choice five, because I think this is really important, especially as you have more responsibilities and your time is so demanded. Choice five is fuel your fire, don't burn out. So can you elaborate on that?
Yeah. So again, we've talked about this a lot. The brain is the number one tool that needs to be optimized in order to make high value decisions, really stay focused on what's important and keep the rest at bay, and stay, keep focused in the midst of unprecedented distraction that is only going to get worse as technology gets better. And so my brain needs to be really mindful and alert to make the highest value decisions in the midst of that all day long. Your brain requires vast amounts of oxygen and the right kind of glucose to maintain sustainable energy to do all of that. And that's really the key to fuel your fire, don't burn out. And we say there's five energy drivers, five key areas you need to focus in on, move, eat, sleep, relax, and connect. So, you know, exercise, you know, really will get large doses of oxygen. You got to get the right amounts of sleep. You got to eat, you know, you can't eat heavy carbs all day long. You know, you want to go to sleep. If your stress level is too high, you're really killing your brain power. And if you're not, you know, socially connecting with other human beings, you're doing yourself a disservice around productivity. So there's vast amount of research for each of those around cognitive ability and what goes wrong if you're not optimizing most of those at any given moment in time.
And we could talk for hours just on this one thing.
Right.
But, you know, we have a lot of things that go against us because our food supply, it's really hard when we're so busy with the fast food and things, and it's not the best for our bodies, right? And so we have to be mindful, that word you constantly use, about what we're putting in our bodies. And then exercising, I mean, just to be healthy, be, you know, make sure you're fit and then put the right things in your body. But stress is an important thing. And a lot of people feel that when they do have pressure put on them, they perform better. But is that a fallacy? I mean, I feel I can perform better a lot of times when I have a tight deadline. But is it a fallacy long term? I mean, I don't think I could have a tight deadline every day. That would drive me crazy.
So there's two things in there. Let's see if I can remember both to talk about them. The, you know, stress, there's an optimal stress place. You can't have too much stress, but if you have no stress, no tension, that's not good either. You need to find the sweet spot, the optimal, you know, performance zone, as it's called. Tony Schwartz's work goes into that, you know, as well, Jim Lohr. And so you have to find that. So when you say, I do, and I hear this a lot, back in choice one, you know, I always say to people, you can help yourself get out of quadrant one, because quadrant one is stressful. And the bigger quadrant one is, the more stress, and you will burn out. And what I hear people, you know, what I say to people is, become aware, if you are procrastinating, you are letting a perfectly good quadrant two thing drift over to quadrant one. And it's your fault. It's getting bigger and you are stressing yourself out even more. And then its sibling is right to what you're talking about, is people who say or think, I do my best work under pressure. And what that is a bit of the drug addiction. You're looking for the dopamine hit, the neurotransmitter that goes right to the reward center in the brain, and adrenaline. You're looking for that buzz that is a bit of a fallacy that you do your best work. Because really, I'll be honest with you, I have rewired my brain. I am terrified to wait to the last minute, to a deadline coming up on me, to work on something, because I am much more adrenalized by a fear that I know 100% of the time I am never doing my best work if it's too close to the deadline.
Huh,
so right now, I'm fearful, and so I make sure I'm planned out because I have to have my best work handed in.
And what is that? Because you go too fast?
It's just you have no. I think that's part of it. You go too fast. But I think if you think about your own work, how many times, you know, when you've accidentally done it way before the deadline, we're like, all right, I'll start to work on this. And you work on it, and then you put it aside, and a week later you pick it up because you're closing in on the deadline, and you reread your work, and you go, egads, who wrote that piece of garbage? And you throw it in the garbage and you start over again because it wasn't, you know, or you know this, if you're writing something, whatever, you put it down, you work on it again tomorrow and you make edits, you change it. But if I wait till last minute and it doesn't have time to cook, then it's never going to be my best work. So speed could be part of it, but I think just having the time to let your brain really come together, and there's all kinds of science around that too, to really come to the aha moments around what quality is on a particular thing you're working on. If you don't give your brain that space, you're never going to get it. You're never going to get to it.
And that makes, especially around the knowledge work. It's one thing around just kind of the mindless, you got to do stuff.
Yes.
But the knowledge work needs that time to incubate.
That's the, what I was saying before, right in there. And that really is the premise of the five choices. Nobody has, we optimized the work of the manual labor 100 years ago with the assembly line, ISO 9000, TQM, all of those things was to time and motion studies to optimize the work of the manual laborer. Really, what we're trying to say is we need a system for the mental, you know, mental labor. What's the system so that people can really get at their great potential? Because we know people's potential is huge between low performance and high performance. So that's a key point that you're making, that if people understood this and we break this culture of busy and turn it into a culture of productivity, those companies will be so far ahead. It's amazing.
Yeah. So it's the productivity advancement with knowledge work, with creative work. Cause we know how to be productive with more, you know, things that aren't considered knowledge work. But when it comes to creative, hard thinking type tasks, it's different. And you can't just have this, you need the time to incubate it and think about it and develop it and kind of get on that stealth mode airplane.
Right. And knowledge workers are all of us. It could be a finance person, a banker, an accountant, an HR person, a radio personality, a, you know, a director. It's all of that. And I will tell you, Sarah, the research, even going down to low complexity jobs with this study of even fast food workers, they showed that the top 1% performers were 3 times more productive than the lowest 1% performers with a very tight job description. So even in the not so knowledge worker space that I just mentioned, there is capacity and potential that's going untapped that organizations really need to understand. How do you bottle? Because we all have those workers, right? It's like, wow, if we had 10 Sarahs, this place would be great. And it's a wish list. You don't know how to get at it, but that's what the secret sauce is. How do I equip people with the tools that they can really feel accomplished at the end of the day, highly motivated, and come back and do great work again tomorrow?
Well, you can see that in technology work, is that you could have somebody that can do the work of 100 people, and I'm not exaggerating. I've seen it. Or 1,000. I mean, there's some people that just can do stuff that others can't, and they just get vast amount of stuff accomplished. And whereas others, they could spend forever and not get it accomplished. And I suppose that's just skill set too. But there's, even at a reasonable level, there are people that just outperform in vast amounts of, you know, better than other people. And you, I guess this gets into you have a method for determining the price we pay for how we're spending our time. And it gets into that, doesn't it?
Well, yeah. And again, it's everybody taking accountability for each situation and really looking at what the return on the moment is, you know, what return am I getting on the activity I'm about to do? And it was interesting what you said about those high performers, because again, what we think we've done with the five choices is bottle whatever those folks have and turned it into a process that is repeatable for organizations through the middle of the workforce, even down to the lower workforce. So hopefully we're helping people out with that.
Well, that's an amazing concept. I mean, that is in and itself can be, you know, like a revolutionary way of thinking about productivity, in the way that you try to have that extraordinary, you know, get that multiple effect going, that multiplier going.
Exactly. Exactly.
And well, as a CEO, we all know if you aren't making good decisions on a regular basis, the price of that, the cost of that is enormous.
Yep, it is.
And so the knowledge workers, if they're not putting out the best product, you could lose in the market space.
I watch organizations. It's so compelling what you're saying, because I watch organizations that are a culture of busy. And, you know, and they're proud of it. It's like, no, we lock our people in. We feed them all day long. We want them working nonstop. And they're good organizations. But again, you know, with Franklin Covey, our mission is we enable greatness in people and organizations everywhere, and going good to great. You know, it's this is a system that if they would just pause and put a few rules and guidelines in place, not rules, but guidelines, and equip their employees with a few things, I can't even begin to imagine what their outputs would be.
Well, how can leaders implement the system in their companies? What is the best way to go about doing that?
Well, you know, there's in the back of the book, there's a special section for leaders. And it really simply starts with them modeling some of, you know, these behaviors and defining what's important, what's not, constantly getting really clear on that is number one, and creating a safe environment where people can, you know, question and say, this feels a little Q3-ish. You know, can you tell me why it's a Q1? And really be conscious of their technology and how they're aligning it for productivity, not just to create more information, you know, inflow. Wellness, many organizations are doing wellness, but you don't have to spend a lot of money as a leader. It could be just creating a culture where people get up and do walking meetings, or, you know, you talk about parking, or you do some contests around, you know, health. It's those kinds of things. If a leader would just start with that, and of course we say implement the five choices across the organization so everybody's speaking the same language, you know, that's a good start.
And anybody can implement this in their life. It's not just the leaders, but an employee can start to implement and be a leader get their organization to start moving in this direction, even if they're not the manager, right?
Even if they're a frontline person, we see in some of the measurable results of where they're putting their time, attention, and energy, we have found that the front line will increase their time, attention, and energy going to important things more than any other, more than the middle managers or the executives. So they really, when they do the five choices, they really take business into their own hands, knowing that they may not have a lot of power in the organization, but they can get a little more control of their life, both at work and personally.
Well, I got to say congratulations on your book, making it to the top of the New York Times bestseller list. You made it to number 4, and it's been there for a while, hasn't it?
Well, it was the Wall Street Journal.
Wall Street Journal. Okay.
Sure. We were on good ground here. And it was 3 weeks in a row. And we've done, 40 or 50, in press interviews. It was, I was on the Today Show, MSNBC. And so it's been really exciting and really fun to see this all resonating around the world.
Well, where can they buy your book?
You can go to your regular, bookseller, Amazon, Barnes & Noble. You can go right up there. So,
where fine books are sold.
Yeah. Anyways, yeah.
Okay. Well, good. Well, I'm going to include your contact information for Franklin Covey, how to get more information. Can I put that up on the radio page and on my website so people know how to get hold of your company and learn more about this stuff?
Yeah, and I'll give you the direct site to the five choices. It's www.thefivechoices.com. And there's a couple of videos up there, some other information, some case studies from organizations that have implemented around the world. I actually just came back from Sweden with we're working on a case study with Microsoft's offices out there who have implemented the five choices. So you get to see a lot of stuff, and obviously it'll point you to the book as well.
Well, fantastic. Thank you so much, Corey, for joining us today.
Sarah, thank you for having me. Have a great week.
You too.
Again, if you want to find contact information for any of the guests today, go to my webpage at sarahwestall.com or my radio page at webtalkradio.net. And for now, everyone have a wonderful day.